And that should do it. That should stop the widely disdained women's suffrage movement, perhaps once and for all. By one vote? By one vote. That's how hotly contested was the issue of whether women should be permitted access to the voting booth. And Representative Harry Byrne, the very last domino in the row, was refusing to fall. It was incredible in a way that the women's suffrage movement had made it this far. After failing with monotonous regularity for 7 decades, the suggestion that women be allowed to vote was just barely endorsed by the United States House of Representatives in January of 1918. The Senate would not be so eager. In September of that same year, they rejected the requisite constitutional amendment by a scant 2 votes. Not even the controversial daring intervention by President Wilson could urge opponents to reconsider. Among those who stood in the way of women's suffrage was the South, and in a virtual block, their traditional objection was to agitators seeking to destroy the American home. But then at last from the Senate floor, one South Carolina senator voiced this dark reservation. And this is a quote from the record. I warn every man here today that when the test comes, as it will come, when the clamor for Negro rights shall have come, you senators from the South having voted for women's rights will have started it here this day. End quote. Nevertheless, by sunset, June 4, 1919, following yet another narrow defeat in the Senate only 4 months previous, the 19th Amendment had passed both houses of Congress. It was on its way to the states for ratification. 36 states were needed to make it the law of the land. 35 ratified. One hope remained, Tennessee. But the tally in that state's legislature was 1 vote shy. 1 vote, and the solitary no vote that would undo 70 years of labor by the advocates of women's suffrage was about to be cast by a 24-year-old representative named Harry Byrne. Nervous misogynists were reassured that they had nothing to fear, that Harry Byrne was one of them. But guess what? At the last minute, I mean the very last minute, Byrne voted the other way. And it was that one man's decisive vote that gave American women their own vote forever after. Of course, among a great many of his constituents, Harry Byrne was now in trouble. He must account for his betrayal, he was told. And he sure enough did, for just prior to the roll call, he had received a letter from a woman in his district, a woman back in the mountains, and she wrote in part, quote, be a good boy and vote for suffrage. So Harry did. On August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution was ratified. Because after all of the years of rhetoric, eloquent and crude, temperate and vicious, a simple exhortation from a solitary source provoked the solitary vote that changed history. Be a good boy, vote for suffrage. And Harry Byrne did. And it became the law of the land. And he voted on orders from his mother. Now you know the rest of the story.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Edward Ring. He has been on the show a number of times. Can't tell you how much we appreciate that, Edward. He is the director of the Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. And we're going to talk about how outsourcing California's oil production is destroying the environment elsewhere and raising our costs of energy in the state. We're also going to talk about all the other precarious and counterproductive energy policies, which are really forming up to be a perfect storm and bad for Californians. And then we want to talk about other common sense solutions of California's self-imposed water shortages, if we have some time, and what's going to be done about that in this state. Edward, welcome back to PWM.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Barry. It's good to be here.
Yeah, you're getting to be a Paso Robles regular now, you know. I mean, you came down to the, I believe it was the CoLab event a few months ago, and I'm very grateful that you come on the show. It's really informative for our listeners. Folks, you can call or text in with questions, 805-238-5775. 238-KPRL. So, Edward, I'd like to approach some of your recent energy commentary from the broader perspective of the religion known as climatism. COP30, which is the 30th annual UN climate conference, was held earlier this month in Brazil. Conspicuous by their absence were Presidents Trump and Xi, as well as Prime Minister Modi of India. Most of the commentary that came out of the conference indicated that basically the Paris Climate Accords, which were a big deal a decade ago, are a dead letter, and the entire religion of catastrophic climate change has been run over by economic development and the exorbitant cost of trying to mitigate really what's proven to be a very minuscule impact on our climate. So what are your, big picture thoughts on this, what came out of the energy conference in Brazil?
Well, I don't think anything came out of the conference. I think the what you've just described was the biggest takeaway, which is the fact that it's not being taken as seriously as it was in the past. I think in the past it was really an opportunity for developing nations to sort of get involved with NGOs and influential special interests in developed nations, including the liberal governments, to get money.
So it's kind of extortion of the United States, basically.
Well, I don't know if it was extortion. I think there was a mutual back-scratching going on. I think that the moral argument is somewhat extortionate because it's based largely on fraudulent premises. But the actual, transactional nature of it, I think, helped the special interests in the developed world, and it helped the tyrants and oligarchs in the developing world. There was a mutual benefit there. I don't think it was in the interests of the people at all, and people have been pointing this out for a very long time. You aren't going to help aspiring, upwardly mobile, or people that want to be upwardly mobile in the rest of the world, if all you're giving them are expensive energy solutions and not letting them develop, time-tested conventional sources of energy, which is the foundation of economic prosperity. So they're being victimized by this, but their elites are being enriched by it. And that's blowing up. And I think the biggest thing that changed recently, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with, is Bill Gates surprised
yes.
the whole world when he kind of did a big about-face and repeated what people like Michael Schellenberger in the United States and tirelessly for decades, Bjorn Lomborg, the Danish economist, have been saying exactly what Bill Gates just finally came out and acknowledged. They've been saying it for years, which is that the cost of adapting to whatever climate change we may experience is, orders of magnitude, it's just less and it's more productive. I think a lot of good people will use climate change as an excuse to justify good projects that they can't get through any other way. It's the argument that people that want nuclear power, which is a great practical source of energy in the future, they go, well, you can stop the CO2 emissions if you get CO2. And a lot of these folks don't really believe that, but they know that it's one of the most powerful arguments they can use. So all of that's crashing down, and it's a return to practical solutions, and it couldn't come too soon.
Well, and it's interesting. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was last week, about how China is powering its green energy revolution with coal. What are they building? A coal plant every month to power their efforts there. So it's pretty hard for us to have much of an impact if India and China are building coal power plants, right?
Well, you know, I saw that, and I went ahead and took a quick look at the statistical review of global energy. It's out now for 2024, and in 2024, China's fossil fuel dependency was 88%.
Wow.
Worldwide, it was 86%, but 58%, which is by far the highest in any industrialized nation, 58% of their energy is from coal.
Really?
Another 10% from natural gas and another 20% from oil to get you to that 88%. But, yeah, they're using well beyond half of their sources of energy is coal, 58%.
Wow. And so then in the meantime, Governor Newsom wasted more taxpayer dollars by hamming it up down at COP, signing symbolic agreements with various countries. Do you think this will help in him in his quest for the 2028 Democrat presidential nomination?
No.
That's good.
I mean, I can elaborate. You know, he actually got hammered a little bit when he was down there. I think a flotilla of, you know, all of this stuff's orchestrated, but a flotilla of indigenous peoples floated down the Amazon to Belém, which is, I guess, at the mouth of the Amazon on the Atlantic Ocean, where they have this conference. And these folks were protesting the impact of oil that's been extracted from the Amazon and shipped to California. You know, so I had a look at that, and sure enough, you know, the Brazilian Amazon is 20% of our imports, and Ecuador's 14%, and Guyana is 16%. You know, and when you add all of that up, you know, the total amount of oil, all oil, including what we produce here in California, more than a third of it comes from the Amazon basin. And that's completely unjustifiable, because that's about the amount that we could be producing right now. It would be difficult for California at this point, because we're pretty big. We use a lot of energy. There's 40 million of us nearly. You know, so it would not necessarily be possible for Californians to produce 100% of their oil. But you know what? We could produce the oil that we're importing from the Amazon. We have enough reserves, enough capacity, if we reindustrialized and supported our oil sector. Instead of producing, you know, 23% of our oil, we could produce maybe 40 or 50% of our oil right here in the state, and we wouldn't have to import one drop from the Amazon.
So yeah, let's unpack this a little bit now, because really what's happening is California, because it's deliberately running the oil industry out of the state, is shifting and getting the oil from South America, a lot of it, and importing it. And they also get quite a bit from Iraq, I noticed, in some of your articles.
The Middle East is and the Amazon basin would account for almost all of the oil we import.
And I'll use this term loosely, what do our genius policymakers in California thinking? Why do they think it's better to do that than to do this, have control over our own resources and do it here, do the drilling here?
Well, that's a tough question for anybody to answer. I mean, what's going through the minds of these folks? I mean, part of it is they want to destroy the oil industry in California, so that if there is some kind of disruption, you know, they want to get the price of conventional fuel as high as they can get it, because they want to make it more profitable for people to build and sell renewables. And if the model is, let's subsidize renewables, let's mandate renewables, and let's attack fossil fuel. And the place we can attack it the most effectively is within our own state. And you put all those things together, and you still have the consumer paying a lot more for electricity, for example, than they will anywhere else. We pay, you know, it's up to over 30 cents a kilowatt hour on average, and that's twice as much as the rest of the country. So, and we're paying almost twice as much for gasoline. But, it's part of a bigger picture, which we're all familiar with, which is that the state legislature has this powerful environmentalist lobby and this powerful renewables lobby that's contributing a lot to their campaigns and making this moral argument that we haven't had enough people standing up to it based on the science or based on the morality, because it's not a good moral argument. There's no basis upon which you can argue that it's better for the environment to, you know, deforest the Amazon and put a bunch of oil rigs out there. That could probably be done with a, you know, mitigating a lot of the environmental harm. It's not necessarily that harmful, but it's certainly more harmful than it would be if we just do it in California, where we have the strictest environmental standards in the world. Why wouldn't we do it here?
Well, really, you're right, because from a global perspective, we produce energy cleaner than everywhere else because we have such strict regulations. So it's really better to do this in the United States than to outsource it.
Well, it is, and I don't want to get ahead of our discussion, but there's other reasons why we ought to be doing it here in California to deplete these fields while we still can. You know, eventually we're going to have, it'll be like the movie Back to the Future, where the scientist arrived in a car that was powered with a fusion reactor on the back, you know.
Right.
I mean, we're going to get there. It might be 100 years, it might be 200 years, it might not even be a century from now, but we're going to invent ways to use energy that won't require fossil fuel. In the meantime, we really ought to get rid of all the oil reserves in our state, because that's what's causing all of the methane leakage. That's what's causing all of the seepage. In other words, if we drilled for more oil in California and depleted all of these oil fields that continually get pushed to the surface because we're on the Pacific Rim and we have active faults everywhere, and we have natural seepage, which is much worse than what we're getting from capped wells or from active wells or from the distribution systems. None of that is significant compared to natural seepage, and the only way to stop it is by depleting those oil fields. So we could actually help California's environment as well as the rainforest if we just drill and extract oil right here in California.
So interestingly, last week we had a 4.1 earthquake right here in Paso Robles. It was actually in Templeton. It was only 3 miles away, and we had a bunch of aftershocks, you know, for several days. It was really quite something. Which leads to the other article that, you know, you're referring to. You wrote a very interesting article on your California Policy website about how oil extraction could really reduce methane seepage in California. Why don't you explain that a little bit and why it would be a good policy to follow here?
Well, you know, I covered that a little bit already, and there's not all that much to add. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a petroleum geologist, forget his exact specialty, but a professor at UC Berkeley worked with a bunch of his graduate students and did a massive study down in Los Angeles County looking at, well, what are the actual sources of methane leakage and all the other volatile organic compounds which come out of the ground from natural seepage and also from capped wells. And what they discovered was that the oil industry itself and the active wells, because they're so carefully regulated, are not responsible for more than less than 1% of the methane leakage and other pollutants that they're encountering that are related to oil. And what they discovered instead was that it's just coming out of the ground naturally. Every time there's any kind of tembler, we have extremely active faults in California. Mm-hmm. There, you know, the state is just crisscrossed with earthquake faults. And we also have a lot of oil underground in California. And every time the earth shifts a little, more of that oil comes to the surface, and it comes out naturally. And in fact, in Los Angeles County, there's the highest density of crude oil per square mile. You know, it's not the biggest reserve of oil in the world, but it's the highest density per square mile. The amount of oil that's underground in Los Angeles County has the highest density of anywhere else in the whole world. You know, and you see that if you go to the beach and there's tar on the sands and it's just been seeping out naturally. It's not from the rigs that are out there. There have been accidents, But that's been cleaned up a lot. The safety standards are a lot more than they were back in the 1970s when they had a big oil spill. Things have improved a great deal since then. But why are we still seeing all this oil on the beach? And it's because it's coming out of the ground naturally under the ocean and also on land. You see that if you fly over the Gulf of Mexico, you see all these oil slicks, and the first thing somebody will think is, oh, that's, the wells. Those wells, they're filthy. They need to clean them up. But that's not the source. The source is natural, and it's even worse here in California because of our earthquake faults. You've heard of the La Brea tar pits.
Oh, sure.
Everybody's heard of the La Brea tar pits. That's all oil that's naturally coming up from under the surface.
Yep.
So what they did was they looked at all of these factors, and they realized that, yes, you get methane from dairy farms and landfills and water treatment plants, but most of it is coming from natural seepage, and almost none of it is coming from active or wells. And as far as capped wells go, they kind of present a choice. Do you want to spend literally hundreds of billions of dollars? It would cost over $100 billion to cap every single well. And even if you... the ones that have been deactivated. But even if you did that, the earth would shift and the wells would start leaking again. Plus, they've been drilling for oil in Los Angeles for the last 110 years, and they don't have knowledge anymore of where these capped wells are. So you couldn't go try and identify every dormant well anyway. There's tens of thousands of them. There's,
yep,
there's probably over 100,000 of them. So the solution is to stop the natural seepage by drilling for oil and extracting it and routinely depleting these fields. They estimate, and this is from the USGS, they've estimated there's 5 billion barrels of oil in Los Angeles County. Can you imagine that? So the solution, because they want to shut down the oil industry down there. They want to, the city of Long Beach is going to go bankrupt if they shut down the Wilmington oil field, and that's exactly what the state legislature is trying to do. If they were to reactivate oil drilling in Los Angeles County instead of shutting it all down, they would reduce the pollution instead of just watching it increase.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation on the other side of the break because you've been predicting gas lines and $9 a gallon gas here in California in the not-too-distant future, and I want to get to that topic here. So stand by, Edward. And then in the meantime, folks, we will, be right back.
Ace Auto Care in Atascadero, the best price and service on brakes, tires, smog checks, oil changes, and more. Ace Auto Care, all your vehicle needs, everything you want.
Fox News, I'm Tom Graham. President Trump says progress is being made on a U.S. proposed peace plan to end the Russia-Ukraine war.
In the last month, 25,000 soldiers have died. So I think we're getting very close to a deal. We'll find out.
President speaking today from the White House. The latest peace proposal has prompted a fresh round of talks involving officials from Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and European nations. As part of the 28-point plan, Ukraine would have to cede its entire eastern Donbass region to Russia. Americans feeling less confident about the economy.
The Conference Board Business Research Group's Consumer Confidence Index is at 88.7, down from 95.5 the month before. 100 is considered average. That's tied to what it was in 1985. The most often mentioned factors for the lower reading are prices and inflation, tariffs and trade, and politics.
Fox's Chris Foster, America's listening to Fox News.
Do you use propane for your home or business? Family-owned and operated, Delta Liquid Energy has provided local area residents with dependable and courteous propane service since 1936. From home heating and cooking to powering your irrigation engine pump or forklift, propane can do it all. Don't forget their location. Paso Robles refills propane bottles of all sizes Monday through Friday and has a dump station for your RV. Learn more. Call Delta Liquid Energy 805-239-0616 or go online DeltaLiquidEnergy.com.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, who is the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. You can call or Text in with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Edward, I'm going to try to wrap kind of this whole topic up about oil and at least fossil fuel energy here in California. You know, you've been predicting for quite some time that, you know, with our current policies, we're going to be sitting in gasoline lines and we're going to be looking at gasoline that's probably close to $9 a gallon. In the meantime, this has finally dawned on at least Gavin Newsom that this is going to be a problem for him. So he's trying to make nice to the oil industry to some extent. Who knows how that's going to play out? And I'm interested in what you think about that. And then the other item that's just been kind of added to this mix is that President Trump wants to sell offshore leases, many of them here in the Central Coast. And of course, there's probably already lawsuits brewing to stop that as well. So how do you see this all playing out between now and the next election and then certainly into the presidential sweepstakes in 2028?
Sure. I mean, I don't recall ever saying $9 a gallon. There was a professor at USC, he's predicted, he had a study that came out about 6 months ago that was very well publicized. He predicted $8 a gallon. And I think that would be probably on the high side. You know, they would impose price controls before they would allow it to get much higher than that. I think that you would see gas lines because there would be price controls and rationing of gasoline before you'd see gas going for $9 a gallon. However it plays out, it's going to be tough.
Yeah.
Even if it's not that bad, there's going to be some problems. And the reasons we think so are, first of all, we've got the refinery closures. And that's going to be very hard to stop at this point. The major oil refiners stopped investing in efficiency improvements and normal maintenance and upgrades. You know, they're doing the bare minimum, and they've been doing the bare minimum for many years because they see the writing on the wall. They know they've got a hostile state legislature they have to deal with, hostile agencies, escalating restrictions. And a year ago, two of them, Phillips 66, I think they're in Long Beach, and then the plant at Valero up in Benicia, they both said we're going to shut down. Now, what you got is 1.4 million barrels a day. That's demand in California. When you take those two, Phillips and Valero, out of the refinery mix, you're down to 1.3 million barrels a day. And you're not supposed to, first of all, just have equal between supply and demand. You have to have a surplus supply capacity, which is what we have until those two go away, because there's inevitably shutdowns here and there for maintenance. These refineries don't run at 100% of capacity all the time. So you're going to be way under the amount of gasoline you're going to need to fulfill demand when those two refineries shut down, which they're scheduled to do next year. And they're going to have to make that up by importing gasoline. And that's not easy to do, because imports of gasoline that are refined to California's unique formulations, it's just very hard to find. So they're scrambling right now, all over the world to see what refineries they can identify that are able to take they take a lot more sulfur out of the gasoline for California's reformulation. And I don't understand the formula thoroughly enough to describe exactly what's different. But it's designed so that you don't have pollution as bad in our coastal valleys, which are up against the ocean, and all of the residual air pollution, even from our really, really clean tailpipe emissions nowadays, gets trapped against the hills. So even if you have less pollutants coming out of your vehicle, it accumulates here a lot more than it would accumulate in Dallas, let's say. So they have special formulations. Nobody in the world set up to make this formulation. That's all unique to California. So it's going to be really hard for them to import gasoline. Plus, our receiving facilities aren't set up to store gasoline. They're set up to store crude oil. And so you have to make some adaptations there. Plus, you're going to have more imports. So you have to have more capacity in general. So none of that is, they haven't planned for any of that. And at the same time, we risk seeing a crash in our own in-state crude oil supplies because they've outlawed new wells. They didn't give out drilling permits for 5 years, and now they're scrambling to suddenly give out drilling permits again. But the life cycle of a well in California is only 20 to 25 years. So when you go 5 years with negligible permitting, you end up putting this big gap in the pipeline of new well production. And that is going to take years to fix. And meanwhile, the industry's left. All the rigs, all of the workers, they've all found jobs elsewhere. They've found use for their equipment. These companies that do the drilling and maintenance of all of these wells, they've all gone to Texas or North Dakota or Brazil or wherever they've gone. And they're not here. And to bring them back, they would have to have confidence that the state isn't going to be attacking them for at least 20 years so they can get a return on their investment. And meanwhile, as this production inevitably falls by about 15% a year in California, the pipelines that move oil from California's fields to the refineries are already at their minimum capacity. If you have less than 25% of the capacity of a pipeline, an oil pipeline, available, they can't operate the pipeline because they can't get enough pressure in there to push the oil through the pipe. Plus, it costs a lot more. If you have a pipe, the fixed costs to maintain that pipe and most of the costs to operate it are pretty fixed. But you have one quarter as much oil going through that pipe. You have to apply all of those overhead costs to one quarter as much revenue. So you have to charge a lot more just to distribute oil. So all of these things, okay, the refinery capacity, our own drilling capacity, both in decline, our ability to actually pump this oil around the state through pipelines could go away in some cases, and you'd have to put them into trucks. So all of these things are happening right now, and they're all happening together. It's a perfect storm, and there's going to be trouble. The real question is just how bad will it get?
And would a Governor Katie Porter or Eric Swalwell make this better for us?
Well, you're just, that's a softball. You're asking me to say something mean about the who knows, right?
I guess it was a rhetorical question. How's that?
Well, even if you had a great governor, a great governor can do a lot, right? They can issue executive orders. If we could finally get rid of the supermajority, they could veto really bad legislation. They can fire heads of agencies and put people in that have more common sense. So a good governor can do a lot, but even a good governor is up against a state legislature that is united in their determination to get rid of so-called, fossil fuel. And they're up against agencies with entrenched activist career bureaucrats that themselves are determined to destroy the oil industry in California. So, it would be tough even if you had a good governor.
Yeah. Yeah. Interestingly, I saw a poll where Sheriff Bianco was actually leading in the poll by a couple of percentage points. Everybody was in the teens in the poll, but at the top level. But still, he would get it. And what could he get done actually if considering the overall government in California? But anyway, let's kind of shift gears. Let's talk about something more positive now. You wrote a lengthy essay, I believe it's on your California Policy website. Called Silicon Valley's Growing Anti-Woke Pro-Abundance Rebellion. And in it, you discuss how the current state and local political class thwarts growth and abundance through multiple public policy mechanisms, in the areas of water, energy, and housing. And there's actually some pretty startling stuff that you uncovered in this. But, you give us some good news that really Silicon Valley is leading the innovation charge in California and may come up with a way to pull our bacon out of the fire. So why don't you take some time here to unpack this essay, because it's really got some great information in it. And it kind of leads back to what you said about, Bill Gates, that, he's starting to see the daylight on certain things. So now I'll let you comment on your own essay.
Well, thanks. It's a speculative essay. It's might be wishful thinking. It's sort of the same question. How much are they going to change? How big will this shift be? But there is a shift happening, and we've seen this with a growing number of, first of all, there's almost 200 billionaires living in California, and the majority of them are Silicon Valley moguls that founded a company or were got in early at a company and were, just got fabulously wealthy. I think the market capitalization of just the big, the half dozen or so biggest companies based in the Silicon Valley, it's over $10 trillion. There's just a lot of power down there. That is probably, if you were going to identify one special interest that could do anything they wanted to do if they were united, it would be them, because they have not only all of that money, but they also have a lot of influence. I mean, these are the social media giants. These are the search giants. So these are companies that also have the ability to influence public opinion with their products. So you have two reasons why they're just incredibly powerful, and they can do anything they want if they unite and set their minds to it. And for all of these years, we've been terrified of this power because we've been watching it subvert our country instead of elevate our country. But that could be changing. And there's a variety of reasons it could be changing. I mean, a lot of it was this pent-up resentment at the fact that they were forced to devote 20% or more of their overhead to diversity hires and human resources departments that themselves became commissars, making work uncomfortable for the really productive people in these companies. A lot of really smart, productive people are eccentric, and they don't have a filter. They say things, and then all of a sudden you've got a commissar running around who got a degree at some Ivy League school and has decided that certain forms of speech, even if it's just innocent and spontaneous, are going to, could get somebody fired, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a cultural resentment, especially among the most productive members of these companies, that something's wrong. And the founders also, we know that through the activism in the companies and through their own political biases, they were engaging in some censorship, but they were also, especially after 2016, subjected to enormous pressure by, agencies of the federal government, as we've learned, to do this censoring. And I think a lot of them resented that, even though they, may have aligned philosophically with some of the objectives. I think they didn't like being told what to do. And so you had all of this stuff in the background. And then all of a sudden, so that kind of paved the way for what's happening next, which is for a long time, they were exempt from California's restrictions on any kind of development, because all they were doing was making software and websites and outsourcing their chip designs to manufacturers all around the world who didn't have to live with California's regulations. And then they realized, when they wanted to build a data center, that not only did they face almost insurmountable, even for companies with their wealth, obstacles in terms of just getting the building permits for all of this stuff, and these are people that are used to building a company in 18 months, and
yes,
selling it and making billions of dollars, and all of a sudden they're finding in 18 months they can't even get to the first permit review. They're facing decades of back and forth, which land developers have been enduring in California for the last 50 years. It's just gotten worse and worse. But they're encountering this, really at a big scale for the first time. They can't build their data centers. And then they can't find energy for their data centers anyway. And they're also, they got involved in other things. There was a group, it's called California Forever. It's got a bunch of billionaire investors from the Silicon Valley. They wanted to build the perfect new cities to increase our housing supply in California. They wanted to go to Solano County, just north of San Francisco. It's marginal land. It's not even really very good land for cattle ranching. It's not sensitive ecosystems. It's just a perfect place to build more housing. It's within commuting distance of San Francisco, and it was going to be a progressive urban planner's dream. It was going to have a percentage of low-income housing. It was going to have wind power and solar power and water recycling and mass transit. It was going to have everything that you're supposed to have, and they hit a brick wall. The litigators came out, the bureaucrats came out, the public sector unions came out. They stopped them in their tracks. So there's all these reality checks that are suddenly hitting these folks because they're not just doing software development anymore and chip design that's outsourced. They're trying to do real projects that involve a scratch in the ground and a footprint of energy and water consumption, and they're finding out they can't. And they're not used to finding out they can't do something. They're not used to losing. These are people that are going to fight hard, and they're going to change a lot of the stuff that's stopping development in California. You also saw that book that came out, Abundance, by Ezra Klein. You know, and of course, their solution, this is a Democrat who wrote this book, is their solution is let's get rid of all the restrictions on renewable energy and infill development. But as you and I both know, that's not going to produce abundant energy and abundant housing. Right. So they're going to run into a brick wall there as well. And you've got people one by one changing. Obviously Elon Musk, Larry Ellison, Mark Andreessen, you know, even Mark Zuckerberg is starting to change. And so you've got all of these really powerful people in the Silicon Valley that have made up their minds. We're going to have enough energy for our data centers. We're going to get permits to build them. We're not going to offshore these things. And I think it's going to change the politics in California.
Well, I'm not rebutting what you're saying. It would be nice if it did that. I mean, what I'm kind of seeing from my perspective, though, of course, you know, they're talking about putting a wealth tax on billionaires in California on the next ballot. And we are going to talk about Prop 50 before the show is over, probably on the other side of the break, because you wrote a good piece on that in American Greatness that I wanted to touch on before we end up. But you know, between New York City and how hostile California is to wealth creation these days, I mean, aren't you seeing some sort of shift in the center of gravity of our country down into the south of the country, from an economic perspective? I even saw in a news report on the business news this morning about how people are sending their kids to schools in the south because they're not as woke as the schools in the north, and they're a better financial deal. So I mean, it seems like the whole center of gravity of the country is shifting before our eyes. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that goes back to the question of what's going to happen with the Silicon Valley, and are we really, do we have any genuine basis to be optimistic at all? You bring up education. California is 15% Asian. You know, the country at large is 5% Asian. And we've seen what happened with these, Asian immigrants value education more than average, let's just say. I think that's a fair generalization. It's a positive stereotype, so hopefully I'm not in trouble for saying it. Look at what California's Asian parents did in San Francisco. When they encountered the whole COVID lockdown, they saw what their children were being taught, and they went to school board meetings and realized that the entire focus of the school boards was renaming high schools because somebody, was allegedly racist in the 1850s. And so why did we name our high school after him? We better change the name. Instead of talking about when are we going to open our schools back up to have in-classroom instruction, and why are our test scores so low, and why are we closing down Lowell High School to elite students and making it a lottery system instead because, oh my God, too many Asians are being admitted to the school because they tend to excel academically at a higher percentage than they're represented by in the population. They're not going to tolerate this stuff anymore. These folks in California are becoming politically active. And in the meantime, we've already seen in the Silicon Valley, and the tech industry is behind this as well, we've seen a lot of pushback against the teachers union because they're realizing that there are ways that we can teach K-12 students that aren't being experimented with. They're getting rid of some of the things that work. They're replacing them with indoctrination. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I would argue against the idea that education is a hopeless case in California. I think people are rising up in a bipartisan way to demand excellence.
Well, I hope you're right. And we're going to touch on that on the other side of the break because you wrote a great essay, again, about Prop 50 and why that's so bad. And again, that's my question is, where are we going after that vote? But let me put you on hold, Edward. And we will be right back, folks, in about 3 minutes. So stand by for the wrap-up.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Charles Payne, and this is the Fox Business Report.
Shares of Symbotic surging Tuesday. Symbotic makes AI-enabled robotic technology for Walmart's warehouses and distribution centers. The Massachusetts-based company posted earnings that beat Wall Street estimates. Abercrombie & Fitch stock skyrocketing Tuesday. The clothing retailer lifting its full-year outlook, bolstered by sales at its Hollister stores, jumping 6.8% last quarter. Alibaba reporting a loss of 53% in net profit last quarter amid food delivery competition. The Chinese e-commerce giant's revenue growth remains steady, bolstered by its AI consumer business. Stocks rallying big time Tuesday on December rate cut optimism. The Dow ending up 664, S&P 500 up 61, NASDAQ up 154. And that's your Fox Business Report. I'm Laura Cantor, invested in you.
If a Lenovo computer for your business is on your holiday list, don't shop around. Just go directly to the source, Lenovo.com. You'll find exclusive deals on the PCs you want for your business, like the ThinkPad X9 14 Aura Edition and Yoga 7i 2-in-1. So avoid all that shopping chaos and price comparing, and just go directly to the source, Lenovo.com, where PCs are up to 50% off. That's Lenovo.com.
Lenovo, Lenovo.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers welcomes Heather Bourdain to its team of commercial property casualty professionals. With more than 20 years of experience, Heather can design insurance solutions that protect your business. Whether you're a contractor, winery owner, farmer, rancher, or manufacturer, Heather is the right person to survey your needs and develop innovative solutions to protect your most important asset. Contact Heather today, 805-540-3900, or Heather at AdlerBelmontGroup.com.
Hi, this is Chris from We Help You Legal. Legal documents should be simple and affordable. At We Help You Legal, there are no lawyers and no high costs. Just certified experts to assist you with living trusts, wills, divorce matters, corporations, and LLCs.
Hi, I'm Christina. We also offer notary services. You can find us online at WeHelpYouLegal.com or call 805-237-7770.
We Help You Legal, your Central Coast legal document company.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're wrapping up here with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. You can call or text with questions, 805-2385-775-238-KPRL. Next week's show will feature, I think, some really great guests as well as we had today. Erica Scott, who is a strategic business advisor and a fractional COO, we're going to talk, is going to be on with me for the first segment. We're going to talk about the silver tsunami and closing the value gap in your business. And then for the hour, 1 to 2, I have the pleasure of having Professor Leo Hanian, a UCLA professor of macroeconomics and also at the Hoover Institution, will be joining us to talk about many of the things that are happening in our economy, the Fed, and all that kind of stuff. So I look forward to having you back next week with me. Edward, so I want you, you wrote, again, another great essay in the American Greatness website. So that's why, people should go read this. And it's entitled, How a Parody of Citizen Government Turned California into a Hyper-Gerrymandered State. And, of course, this was about Prop 50. And I just want to preface, and I want your comments, and I'm going to, but I was just amazed at a couple of things from this. First of all, even in a relatively purple county like San Luis Obispo, how the yes vote was driven by Trump derangement syndrome, OK, okay, amongst people in the mostly in the southern part of the county, I noticed. Saw all these comments on Nextdoor. And then the lack of, what do they call it? Low propensity Republican voters who didn't go to vote. And it was a very, to me, that just the vote result was disappointing in and of itself. But you had some interesting comments about why this is really horrible policy for California and why it's a bad thing. So I'm going to let you, you know, wrap up with these, your comments there, please.
Sure. You know, the worst part about it is we, to me, is sort of the initiative process itself. You can only invalidate an initiative with an initiative. And there's only two ways to get an initiative on the ballot, and this is where I think there's an injustice at work. The citizens' initiative, the truly, in the sense of the word, would be when you go out and you gather, you know, close to a million signatures, or for an amendment, over a million signatures. You have 6 months to do it, and if you can do that, they all have to be registered voters. You get it on the state ballot. But I guess what's called a citizens' initiative that I would more accurately, I think, refer to as a politician's initiative is when the state legislature wants to put an initiative on the ballot. They just hold a vote, and they send it to the governor, who signs it, and they send it to the secretary of state, and it's on the ballot. Seems to me that the only way to invalidate a citizens' initiative should not be with a politician's initiative. It should be with another citizens' initiative. Even then, you're up against, you know, special interests that spent over $150 million to pass Prop 50. And the opponents, even with so much at stake, only raised about $40 million. So they were outspent grotesquely. And I think that's one of the biggest flaws in California's otherwise thankful. I'm thankful we have the initiative system, but it shouldn't be so easy for the legislature to put initiatives on the ballot, to fill initiatives that the people actually voted to into being. So apart from that, you're absolutely right about the Republican turnout, which was abysmal, and I have to... You know, I have to wonder what's going on with the state Republican Party. I think that's a whole separate conversation. I think that the money that was spent, the $40 million they raised, they could have simply used to get out the vote instead of buying air and trying to compete, you know, on a 3 or 4 to 1 basis with the bad guys. So, you know, that's another thing, though, that you're going to see perpetually in California politics, which is that most of the big money, even in-state conservative money, looks at the landscape and they say, all right, I can spend, you know, $100 million to, and I might lose in a state ballot initiative. You know, we got 7 media markets, we got 40 million people. It's really hard to saturate the air with a message in California. And the other side's got all this money. They're willing to spend it. You know, the public sector unions alone can spend, they spend about, I don't know, $1 billion every election cycle on lobbying and politicking and so-called information campaigns that they don't have to declare as political spending. And you're up against that perennial source of money along with all the other special interests that like things just the way they are. So somebody who's wealthy in California looks at the rest of the country and they go, wow, I can go to 6 battleground congressional districts around the country and swing the election with that money. Or, you know, excuse me, maybe 20, right? I mean, $100 million is going to go a long ways. So why would you risk it on a ballot initiative in California? That's where we need people like the Silicon Valley to, you know, to come around, because that's where we would find the support to really do it right. And then you've got to get people that are used to winning. When you have perennial money, you attract professionals that learn how to win, and they're accountable, and they win. And that's what the Democrats have. The Republicans don't, because the best professionals go to places where they can find the right amount of support from donors, and they are in a political environment where they can win. So we're up against a lot of structural disadvantages in California.
Do you see these lawsuits, these possible lawsuits against Prop 50, having any chance of success?
Well, I wouldn't bet on it.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, I hear the bumper music coming up. Edward, as always, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your day to talk to me and our audience, and have a great Thanksgiving. And folks, I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving as well. So, and I'll talk to see you next week. Thank you, Edward.
Thank you, Barry.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com. AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.